From Studio 22, you're listening to Servcast with your host, William Lamb. Servcast is dedicated to challenging those who have a desire to serve, lead, and make the world a better place through the love of Jesus Christ. And now, here's William.
Welcome to Servcast. We're glad you joined us today. Now, we have a repeat guest on our episode today. Noel Castellanos is the president of CCDA, which is Christian Community Development Association, and he was a past guest of ours, I think in episode 40. Is that right, Grayson? Episode 40. And so we're going to be right back with this interview. So prepare your minds and your hearts. Tune in. You're going to enjoy it. It's going to be challenging. And I can promise you, it's probably something you'll take away with it. Faith, leadership, and service. And we'll be right back to talk about faith. Noel, welcome, my friend. We're glad you're here with us.
It's good to be here right across the table.
This time, right?
This time, yeah.
Last time we were a few state lines across, right?
Exactly.
But well, you recently spent some time with us at Lee University, and you were here for a chapel. You made a statement at the end of that chapel today, and you said, you asked the question, you know, what does your faith require of you? I'll be honest with you, it probably wasn't the most non-confrontational chapel I've ever been to at Lee. You know, it was confrontational just by nature of the fact that we maybe uncertainties cause us to not necessarily, you know, look through accurate lens from time to time. We look through our lens of our own living and life. So it was a challenge for me personally and a challenge for many of the people in the room. You made the statement, what does your faith require of you? So in this particular segment of our episode, faith, talk to us about this whole immigrant perspective from biblical scripture and a biblical perspective, and bring us into some enlightenment on that. Will you do that, Noel?
Yeah, I think that one of the most helpful things for me, because again, I had to confess that this wasn't my issue, right? I mean, even though being Latino, it wasn't my reality, and so I've had to learn, like everybody else, about this. So the idea that that began to surface time and time again is, well, I like a Old Testament theologian said, the biblical Hebrew word for immigrant or stranger appears repeatedly in the Old Testament, her. And 82 times it's in the Bible, and it's a variation of a similar theme, which is that strangers in the economy of God and the people of God were to be treated with great love, compassion, care, and that their faith actually required that. And then you look at the New Testament, the trifecta of the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, really says, "Hey, that's one of the demonstrations that we have an authentic faith, that we're really looking after the stranger." And so, one thing that I am very clear about is that there isn't one verse that you read and say, okay, that's a text proof for coming alongside immigrants. I think it's the whole gospel story, the whole revelation of God, his commitment to those on the margins, his own social position as a Galilean Jew, the idea that God came, we know that he describes himself, and we see him revealed as a father, a loving father. Well, a loving father that it seems to always gravitate to the one child that's not doing well. And as a dad, I've known that, right?
Sure.
When one of my kids was hurt or sick, I was okay leaving the other two alone for a little bit while I tended to the care of the very, very vulnerable. And I think that's the heart of God. to do that. And so while we kind of are pushed in a national setting to say, well, we have to address this in a political way by looking at laws, mm-hmm. You know, I think the bigger ethic is, how do we as Christians love and view our immigrant brothers and sisters from wherever they are, mm-hmm. As men and women created in the image of God? And one of the challenges to that is the way that our culture has begun to label these individuals as illegals. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, they're aliens, mm-hmm. right? They're like hardly not human. Mm-hmm. And the minute we label anybody, we're in trouble.
Sure.
Because then you can treat them any way you want. Mm-hmm. And we create a narrative and a justification for a certain type of treatment. And I think as Christians, we've got to examine that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me push back a little bit on you here, Noel, because I agree. Let me go on the record to say that I agree with you wholeheartedly, but I also understand that there is this struggle. Now, I'm white as you can get, I suppose, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm from the South, mm-hmm. and but I'm probably the most non-prejudiced person I know, mm-hmm. and the most inclusive as far as helping people and, you know, treating people with dignity and,
sure.
and treating them fairly. But a concern of mine, I think, is because, unfortunately, in this whole DACA movement and the pitfalls that have occurred with this, with, you know, maybe the United States government not doing some of the things they could have done even much further back than 14 years ago, many yeah. years ago, mm-hmm. to make space and create opportunities for people.
Right.
And I think that's the reason we get so many immigrants in our country, is because it is a land of opportunity.
Sure, sure.
The challenge, I think, and so help us understand what would be a good faith response to this. The challenge mm-hmm. is that realizing that the unfortunate reality of labeling typically presents the idea by some that if you are illegal, mm-hmm. If you are, you know, an immigrant here, regardless of why you came, mm-hmm. then you also might be labeled as a criminal. You know, that unfortunately sure. has a relationship as well. That's not the case with everyone. We do right. understand there are people who were born in the U.S. that are, right. that are, you know, breaking laws. There are people right. who are migrants to the U.S. who are breaking laws. What's a good biblical way to approach that and say, you know what, we're really about creating space, opportunity, legitimacy, and we care about people? And what's a real biblical approach to that? Does that make sense? Is my question making sense to you?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you're describing a reality mm-hmm. of kind of an approach that we seem to be seeing lived out in front of us.
I don't like it.
On
it's
cable
a
news every yeah. day, yeah. right? And unfortunately, President Trump has been. I don't think he's done it to the same degree in his presidency, but for sure in the campaign, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a lot of his platform, mm-hmm. and so that, I think, gave permission to a lot of people who maybe were feeling like they were losing out in this whole conversation about mm-hmm. inclusion mm-hmm. and treating people equally or whatever, and so there's been kind of an unleashing of this type of hate speech, which is what I would call it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no sugarcoating, right? Mm-hmm. And I just think anytime, again, I think as Christians, the idea that we see people as new creatures, mm-hmm. okay, especially if you're a believer, which there are a lot of believers that are in that situation, okay, mm-hmm. of being here undocumented and filling churches all over the country. But also that we view the humanity and the dignity of every human being. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we have compassion. You know, you see a homeless guy or woman and, somebody who's an alcoholic or somebody who's in whatever kind of struggle, and what moves us to want to say that person is worthy to help, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, and in the church and Christian ethos is that all of us are redeemable, mm-hmm. right? And which means that all of us are broken, mm-hmm. To some degree,
sure.
right?
Even President Trump.
Even
President Obama, Noel, even William, all of us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, listen, you know that that's the story of Jesus, is that we all, like sheep, have gone astray.
Sure.
Right? There isn't anybody that can avoid that reality. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, going back to your comment earlier about, you know, once we start labeling, we just get in a lot of trouble. Man, I like how you said that, and I agree with that 100%. And just now as you were talking, I thought there's one label that I would love to, for the rest of my life, have attached to me, and that's redeemed. You know, and I think that your comments earlier, when I heard you speaking at Lee University Chapel, you know, you were challenging us that really the process of helping people come to the place of redeemed in their relationship with God so that they can experience eternal life. Mm-hmm. But that's not the end of the story.
Right.
At the front end of this thing, we have to be very compassionate, caring, loving, forgiving.
Right.
And also, you know, holding to the reality of helping people to get to the right place where they are currently in life, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that I also am, I was going to say, I'm trying to find the right word. Am I blessed? I have the reality of the fact that I've lived in poor neighborhoods for most of my life. Mm. And the first half, because that's where I was born into. Mm-hmm. Second half, because I've chosen to do that, to be close to the individuals that God has called me to work with. And the perspective from that vantage point in this country is very different than many white evangelical believers. So it is fascinating to me whenever we have discussions about social issues and theology, that we come to such different conclusions. Mm. And as I listen, a lot of it has to do with our own context and our own upbringing. And all of us have a tendency to create faith in our own image. Mm. Okay.
Say that again. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah. Well, I think it's that we all tend to create faith in our own version of God, in our own image. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to recognize that. And that, I think that creates a great deal of humility, that there's something to learn from everybody, right? And like I tried to say somewhere today, I don't think it was a chapel, but in another gathering, that it's very difficult to communicate hard dialogue on hard topics when we are not used to having respectful dialogue.
True.
Where we can present our different ideas and go back and forth and still walk away caring about each other. And
as brothers and family.
Exactly. Yeah. We may not agree, but boy, I tell you, I love you, you know? Yeah. And so the idea is unless we want to stay divided and everybody just stay to yourself, then it's not going to be easy. Mm-hmm. We're going to have some hard conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of conversation where, I mean, I think most people of color in this country, for the history of our country, we've heard many assumptions and statements made by the dominant culture that have made, you know, folks cringe, okay? But they haven't been able to say anything. Because of their social position, either they're slaves or they're illegal or whatever, and so I think that is an experience that it seems like now many white Americans are beginning to experience, and there's a reaction against it, you know, and I think it just I don't think that my goal is not to. This is not retribution. It's just the experience that I think folks are beginning to realize that we're going to have to be able to say the hard things, and if we're going to get past this. And So I wish I was called something different some days. I'm working on mass incarceration. I'm working on poverty. I'm working on immigration. And every one of those issues are loaded on economic, you know, equity and figuring out how do we overcome poverty in this world, and in our country in particular that it has got the most advantageous, you know, position to be working on that from. And I work with Christians from every sphere of the denominational spectrum, and I think what holds us together is this common commitment to say we want to find God's heart on this. We want to see what does the Word say about love and caring and compassion and redemption and humanity, the image. And I can find no more compelling kind of understanding or in my reasoning, I look at the world and I say the world is not what God intended it to be. And that's impacted everything. And so that work of redemption is a work that is ongoing. And, you know, Paul says, you know, to work out your salvation every day. What does that mean? You know, we have struggled with that because aren't we saved once and for all? Well, we always have to be converted. We always have to be open to the idea that maybe what we held to be true for a long time, we've got to change our behavior, and there's all kinds of examples of that.
And there's another passage that Paul referred to, Galatians 2 and 20, that's probably one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible. I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. The life which I now live in the flesh, in the tangible form, and the reality of us being able to sit across the table and talk about this is actually only made possible, you know, because of God's grace, basically, in my life. And so I so appreciate the humility and the genuineness of your approach to say, I was going about my life, you know, legal, enjoying life. So I think the challenge to us today is whether you're, you know, what color doesn't really matter. The reality is we're all challenged by our faith, by the faith in Jesus Christ who loves us to make a difference. And you've proven that, and you've stepped out to do that. What are some last minute challenges that you can pitch to us in the area of faith that would be some practical ways for people who might be sitting on this? You know, they may be sitting here thinking, you know what, man, I don't, he seems anti-Trump. He seems anti this. He seems anti that. He seems pro this, pro that. Throw all that aside for a minute. What are some practical ways that people can approach the humanity factor of treating people with dignity that really is at the heartbeat of what you're talking about today, who maybe their personal lifestyle is clouded with so much stuff that we're not aware of? What's some ways they can begin to open their eyes and see like Jesus sees the world around them?
Yeah, I believe that I have a call and a burden to stand alongside the poor and articulate their story. Okay. Now, in many instances, I've said that the worst sin in America is to be poor because this is the land of opportunity. So if you're poor, it's your fault. And I think that it's a lot more complicated than that. And I think that we have been blinded to the fact that sometimes we create systems of poverty by our policies, by the way we understand and organize our society. But the other thing is that when you're on the side of like of the wealthy, okay, and I'm not even talking about race now. I'm talking about economics, class. Once we kind of make it, the book of James becomes very important because the book of James warns us, man, you know, think about all the trouble you have in life. It's the rich that usually have the power, money and power go together to give. You know, and I think he's talking, you know, in terms of like when you look at some of the issues that you might have, he says, look, you got to just understand that showing favoritism and judging people by the size of their pocketbook or what zip code they live in, all of that, those are ungodly kind of things. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we all struggle. That's what I call prejudice. Okay. It's that we judge people by our own standard. Mm. Now, what happens in society is it's really not about you and I being nice to each other only, mm-hmm. because that's the baseline. But what happens when we discover that there are laws and systems that actually systematize people being treated differently because they're poor or of a different race or whatever? And I think that's where we have to dig a little deeper. Mm-hmm. So I'll end with this, and though on faith, it's very possible to sit down with a group of economically stable, dominant culture, or those that really have the system working for mm-hmm. them, and you go to a Bible study in church, and you can have a long discussion on faith, and 99% of what you will discuss to try to challenge each other will be on personal piety issues. Mm. Are you praying? Are you having your quiet time? Are you, how's your lust, your sexual thinking, right? If you're a guy, how are you treating your mother-in-law, your in-laws, or it's all of this kind of deal.
Surface.
And I don't say surface. I say it's individual,
good,
relational, mm-hmm. and internal mm-hmm. piety. You don't hear a question might never come up. Hey, are you promoting in your business policies that include the poor?
Awesome.
Are you going and stepping up in City Hall to advocate for zoning changes that would include housing for the poor? I mean, the public sphere doesn't come up at all. Mm-hmm. That privatization of faith, okay, is absolutely acceptable and possible when you're in the dominant position in a culture. When you're not, when the system doesn't work for you, it's a whole, that's why the black church was the bedrock of mm-hmm. the civil rights movement, because faith was connected to this very, serious issue of injustice, mm-hmm. and they led the way. I think probably the one expression that we found in the white evangelical church 20 years ago was around pro-life issues, mm-hmm. but interestingly, you're not hearing about that mm-mm. at all. Why? We've kind of now our issue is tax reform or some other kind of deal, and we've become, I think we can separate our private lives from our public life.
Mm. As we end this episode of Faith, I want to challenge us, be reminded, that we are called to serve, man. We're called to make a difference. We're called to touch somebody else's life. And, Noel, I believe that you can be an unbeliever, meaning that you don't profess faith in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You can be, and if you don't profess faith in Jesus Christ, you can be kind, forgiving, mm-hmm. loving, benevolent. We see it all the time, you know. But I don't think you can be a professing believer in Christ and not be kind, benevolent, loving, and caring. Because mm-hmm. the nature of Christ, when it, through the power of redemption, transforms our humanity and becomes Christ living in us, per se, mm-hmm. then the fruit of the Spirit is going to come out if he's in there.
Right.
And I really appreciate what you're talking about today, because it seems so tied to the reality that we are called to care, we are called to serve, mm-hmm. and we serve out of our faith base,
mm-hmm.
and we serve out of a loving heart to other people.
Right, right, yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on this. We'll be right back, and we're going to talk about mentors, and we're going to talk about leadership.
Fantastic.
All right, we're right back, and we're going to talk about leadership. Now, a key part of leadership is understanding the value of mentors, right? Noel, are you
absolutely
with us?
Yeah, he's here. I'm there. Yep.
You know, we've had a chance over the last couple of days to eat some meals together and talk and have fun, and kind of what I hope to do is to build a long-lasting friendship with you. And
absolutely.
You know, you're older than me, and not much.
But yes, you're elder. I'm your elder. Thank you. Yeah.
So I think both of us are going into the latter part of our 25 years of ministry, mm-hmm. Focus. And so in doing so for me, I know it's real important to me to make sure that I'm building capacity for those that are students of mine, mentees of mine, whatever the case may be. But you shared earlier in one of our conversations somewhere over the last couple of days about the power of influence and the power of mentors. And mm-hmm. so as we talk about leadership for a few minutes in this last segment of this episode today, what does the Bible say about mentors, and what do you think about mentoring, and how is that being played out in your life, both from a mentor influencing you, and then mm-hmm. now you being very strategic, especially with the CCDA, mm-hmm. to raise up people that will take this vision to the next level in the next generation?
Yeah, I think leadership development, mentoring is the modern translation of discipleship, right?
Nice.
And I think that the idea of life on life, and that's the way we influence others. I love the letter Paul to the Thessalonians, where he says, "I was determined not only to give you the gospel, but my life as well."
Yeah.
Right? That's a verse that's been really meaningful to me over the years. And I see that lived out, obviously, in the life of Jesus, where he brought people along with him, and in that rabbinic kind of tradition, but yet very distinct, because it was walking with them and showing them what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. Taking them along to train and disciple. I love the Gospels for that. And then one of my favorite passages on this idea in the New Testament is the 20th chapter of Acts, where Paul is on his way to Rome, and he is determined to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends up stopping on an island right across from Ephesus. And it says that he was so kind of drawn to the Ephesian elders that he discipled, mm-hmm. and that he helped to start that church, that he called for them, go get them, bring them to me.
Mm.
And then he pours out his heart to them, and he mm-hmm. kind of gives them a little refresher course on leadership. And one of the statements he says is, man, my blood, my conscience is clear.
Mm-hmm.
I've given you everything I can. Mm-hmm. I haven't held anything back from telling you the truth and helping to encourage you to live a life of faith. And then the other thing he says, kind of going back to our last session, he says, it's the only place that I remember in the whole New Testament where there's the red letters of Jesus mm-hmm. in the book of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
And it is where he says, it is more blessed to give than to receive. So Paul is talking about the fact that he did not come in expecting to get from the people he was serving
mm-hmm.
and ministering to. In fact, he went in as a tent maker. He went in to actually create opportunities for generosity, and mm-hmm. and he praised the church supporting other Christians that were suffering. So the idea, like one of the because of what I care about, mm-hmm. Loving the poor, and one of my struggles with the Apostle Paul has been, man, he doesn't talk about the poor too much.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? He talks about the spiritually poor. And yet, when you look at, especially in the book of Acts, a couple times when Paul is being vetted as the apostle to the Gentiles, he has to come before the Jewish council and the church leaders. And now James, who many believe is the brother of Jesus and the author of the letter, he's the leader of that Jerusalem church, and he has to say to Paul, okay, go out, preach the gospel, mm-hmm. and refrain from eating meat strangled, or offered to pagans, and then remember the poor. Mm. Okay. Mm. So Paul was mentored and he was discipled and he was instructed, and he says, no man taught me this. God taught me himself. But obviously there was people around him, like mm-hmm. Barnabas and others that were walking with him. So I think not only on a theoretical level, but on a personal level, that's been my experience in terms of growth. And
so when you think about mentors, what are some characteristics, maybe in a person who was a mentor in your life, some characteristics that you think, man, this is... they didn't have to be this way, but they were, and it made an impact in my life. What are some good characteristics notable in someone who is a biblical-based mentor / discipler?
Yeah, I will start with one who, when I first was being mentored by her, that wasn't the case, but now she's a very strong Christian, and it's really exciting to see her faith development and commitment. But my fifth grade teacher, Mary Jo Reese, was just an unbelievable teacher, the kind of example of a teacher that we all would love to hold up. And she loved her students, challenged her students, got to know their students, parents, and Mary Jo really demonstrated that Every kid is unique and important. And so for me, I shared earlier that I was a college art major,
yeah,
right? And the reason I studied art is because Mary Jo, when I was in her class, I would be writing and drawing while she's talking. And at first, I got in trouble because she says, "Now you're not paying attention." But very quickly, she realized, no, that's the way Noel processes and thinks. And so then the next thing she said, "Hey, I'm sorry that I didn't recognize this, but you really have a talent for art." Now, that was in fifth grade. And I'm absolutely certain that the only reason I studied art is because of Mary Jo. She's at my high school graduation. She's at my college graduation, right? And we're still friends today. So Mary Jo was a great mentor. And then my high school football coach and history teacher, Bob Kellogg, Bob and his family, just again, they just demonstrated care, and he's the one that really took me to through a process of coming to genuine faith in Christ and studying the Bible together and walking together and getting to know each other's families, and it's all of that together. It's not a kind of a blueprint that you just follow and like putting together a mechanical something. It's more like the art of making a great meal,
Yeah.
Which I guess I love to eat, so it makes sense to me. But yeah, Bob's a friend, and today I count him as an incredible mentor. And then John Perkins has been a mentor to me over the last 30 years. And here's an incredible Christian thinker. And at 87 years old, I will spend at least an hour talking to him, and John will just share his thoughts. And I very, very rarely do I say, "Well, this is what I think." Because that's not my time.
No,
that's my time to listen and learn, and hopefully those examples have been ingrained in me. I'm trying to pass on to other young leaders in our movement.
Going back to your Paul reference, it's interesting that at one point in Paul's relationship with John Mark, he pushed him aside. At another point in the latter days of his life, he brought him close.
Right.
And. What are some challenges that you have had to overcome as a mentor now? What are some challenges that you've overcome that would be helpful to for those persons who are listening to us that are ready to really step into that leadership mentoring role? They've been given a lot.
Yeah.
And now they need to start giving it away. What's some challenges that you've had to face, and how did you overcome those?
Yeah, I think that the admonition in the New Testament to not lay hands on people too quickly to ordain them. And you know, because pride, just like I said in chapel that, or somewhere, that the love of money is the root of all evil is one of the statements that we hear. The other one is that pride comes before fall. And so pride, human pride, that needs to be always kept in check and redeemed, and the propensity has to be submitted to the Holy Spirit if you're a Christian leader. When a young person who's very gifted and talented begins to kind of get the affirmation that comes from that, it takes a lot of wisdom to know when to say it's time to go. It's time to set you free to do some things, and when to say, listen, you're not ready for that yet. Here's what I want you to do. When a leader is willing to do the stuff that we all had to do in the process of maturing and growing as a leader, then I think if you see that teachableness and that openness, it's part of that indication that they're ready for that. But I've had to just recognize that sometimes, because you see a vacuum of leadership and you see a young person or leader that seems to be really, really, their charisma is so great, their charism, their gifts are so great, that you kind of don't scrutinize the character and the spiritual maturity to the same degree that you might with somebody that you have a question about. So I think that's been an experience that I've had to learn with both. I think that I felt that folks were trying to find that balance with me, as well as I've been able to do that. The other one is, and it's a little bit related, but there is a sense that when you meet young leaders and they see and what you're doing and they kind of like it or respect it, they want to be like you, and they say, "Well, I want to be like, you know, I want to be invited to places to speak, or I want to get on that plane, or I want to write a book, or I want to do this, I want to serve over here," and so how? And then they'll ask the question, "How do I get to do that?" I said, "Okay, well, tell me, what if somebody were to invite you to come speak? What would they ask you to speak about?" "Well, you know, I could talk about a lot of things." I said, "Well, are you, you know, what are you an expert at? You know, where do you have life experience? Where has God really anointed you?" But basically what you're trying to get somebody to understand is the price to be paid for beginning to have more opportunity for leadership is failure. You know, it's a lot of faithfulness. It's just being there without much fanfare. And all of that, over time, God uses to elevate people and to have their voice become more important. So I think I love our philosophy because when I first got to Chicago, my pastor said to me, a guy that I didn't know at the time very well, but he's the pastor of Lawndale Community Church. He says, because I was there asking, "Hey, I'd love to come to Chicago, work alongside. Would you help me?" And he says, "I really would love to help you, but I need to ask you one question. Are you willing to make a 15-year commitment to come here? Because if you don't make that kind of commitment, you're not really going to do much, you know, in this kind of approach of Christian community development." Well, boy, that challenged me tremendously. And what I began to understand the longer I was there, now I've been there almost 30 years, but what he's saying is, look, you know, are you going to learn? Because what we're trying to do is so difficult in many ways, that you've got to be in it for the long haul. And I hope that's something that that I'm teaching the young men and women, right, that we're working with. And we're blessed in CCDA to have really thousands of young leaders that are in our lives. So
Well, I think it's evident that you're doing that, Noel. You've proven that. You've been there for a very long time. And your the ripple effect of your living, your life, you know, is seen in a lot of other people. I get a chance every once in a while to work with students, you know, and to really pour into them individually beyond the classroom. And mm-hmm. and I see students who have that teachability that you referred to.
Yeah.
And I will often write a card to them, and I'll put this in the card. Learn well so you can teach well. And I think you've definitely learned well and you're teaching well. And the world I live in is better because of it and because of you. And we really appreciate what you do, man. I'm thankful you joined us on Surfcast today. And
I think
the only guest in 40 plus episodes that's returned. So maybe we will make this a regular event, right?
You couldn't find anybody else today.
You were top priority today.
Oh, golly,
we'll see what the bar holds.
Shucks.
But, Noel, thanks again for joining us. We really appreciate you, and we champion your cause and what you're doing. And as you often say, we're familia, and likewise, man, brothers to be, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, brother. Thanks. Awesome to be with you.
Thank you guys so much for joining us on Servcast. Be sure to rate and review us on iTunes and share us on Facebook. Hey, if you've got any questions, send them to servcast22@gmail.com. Thank you guys for tuning in. We'll see you next time on Servcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Servcast. The thoughts and opinions expressed on Servcast are those of William Lamb, his guest, and no one else. Until next time, this is Servcast, signing off from Studio 22.